Hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life. If times get tough, or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, December the 19th, 2024, and this is episode 3601, 3,601 times, plus some special shows, rewinds, flashbacks, etc. We have gotten together and done an episode of the show. I am talking a little more about that right now because it's one of those moments that you just kind of reflect on. One yesterday, we crossed over episode 3600, and that just kind of has a ring to it as being a thing. You know, each 100 episodes is kind of a big deal, especially you get into the 3,000-4,000 range of podcasts. But there's another thing going on. Since this is the week before Christmas week, this will be the last expert council show of the week. And I should say right now, thank you so much to all our council members. I got council culture on the brain. Council members. And I want to let all of you guys out there that are on the council know that I really appreciate you and everything you've done to help grow the show. I want to thank you for how much effort you put into what you do. I want to thank mentions Sean Mills again, who has officially left the expert council because of career demands and a really great opportunity that he's walked into. So thank you for that. I want to say there are certain council members who I do have content for you. And I've got 8 segments today, and I need about 6 to make a show work, including mine. I've got 8, so I've used a lot. The ones that you won't hear today that you know you've sent me, there's nothing wrong with them. If anything's ever wrong, I send it back and tell you what's wrong. It just, that filled up the hopper, and I've got a few in the bank for when I come back in January, because we'll be shut down next week. So thanks to everybody. I'll also let you know you'll be hearing from Ryan Steva, the homestead consultant, that will at least in part be answering some of the questions that used to go to Sean. You'll hear from him today. He's 3 from the end with some information about what he calls the magic of direct solar. I think he's going to be a great addition to the team. There are some other folks that I'm still evaluating as to whether to make them an official offer. But Ryan, maybe you heard it here first, but you will be extended an official offer to join the team going into 2025. I think you're going to be a great addition to what we're doing. So what are we going to talk about today? Dan McAdams and Dr. Ron Paul will talk about why we need to wean off the Fed like we weaned off mainstream media. Mainstream media is dying. And it's not just, I mean, we're tap dancing, some of us, I think, especially those in our community that lean more toward the conservative versus the libertarian side, are tap dancing on the graves of, like, you know, Rachel Maddow and MSNBC and CNN, who have lied themselves to death. But don't think, you know, Fox News has the best ratings. It doesn't mean that they're growing. The whole mainstream media is in decline, and it is a terminal decline, and they know it, and that's why they're being very upset and throwing tantrums about it and shrieking and screaming and blaming Elon and what have you. And nothing like blaming somebody else for what you did wrong, right? You know, and you lost trust, but now it's somebody else's fault because they pointed out that you lied, I guess. But we are weaning off the mainstream media, and most people today, even if they watch the news, they don't trust the news. Isn't it about time we did that with the Fed? That's what Dr. Paul and Dan will talk about today. Chef Ken Daniels will talk about reducing holiday leftovers and making a great holiday meal while trying to, you know, save some money, either by not buying more than you need or being smart about what you buy. I'll have some add-ons to that one. Andy McCann has some free stuff to help get your fitness and diet goals going in 2025. I'll save my thoughts on starting now for a little bit later. But I think it's good to have something to move into. And Andy's got some cool stuff for you guys. John Pugliano will talk about saving money to build a house. And what an accredited investor is, and do you need to be one? And if so, how do you become one? Dr. Ken Berry will talk about why some people get heart palpitations when switching to keto or carnivore. Ryan Steva, the homestead consultant, our newest member of the council, will talk about the magic of direct solar and some ways you can use it. Nicole Sauce, there it is. Why you should start now in improving your diet and life. This is a follow-up from a segment I did a couple episodes ago. I should say, a couple expert counsel shows ago, and it dovetails nice in with Andy's stuff for you going into 2025, because if you haven't started now, you probably still won't start that heavily until, you know, at least Christmas is over, given it is next week, and I get that at this point. But start now means, like, whenever now happens to be, and I think Nicole's advice going into the new year will be helpful. And I'll let you know that I'm going to have quite a few rewinds between my Christmas shutdown and when I come back on the 2nd of January, which, by the way, will be an expert counsel show because it's a Thursday. And a couple of those will be helpful toward your 2025 goals if you waited that long, or I would prefer that maybe they help you take the goals you already are working on to another level. And then I'm going to talk about two things today, pretty briefly on both of them. One, and they're both things that are just being reported wrong by, I won't even say alternative media, by people on social media, by groups on social media, by big accounts on social media that are, it's just dumb the way they're being reported. One is Bitcoin news, and this is coming from a lot of Bitcoin people and a lot of fudsters in the shitcoins, talking about El Salvador made a deal with the IMF to secure a giant loan. Well, there's a reason, and the deal they made really doesn't change much. It just doesn't, okay? And the people that are making a big deal out of it are the same ones that thought it was terrible when El Salvador did what they did in the first place, and now it's terrible that they're undoing a little piece of it. So that will take about 2 minutes to cover. And I also, in a very similar situation here, just a totally different thing, Russia has announced they have a cancer vaccine, and you got all these people shrieking, "I'm not getting a cancer vaccine." Well, first, shut up and know what you're shrieking about. Two, you don't live in Russia. Three, they said they're giving it away for free. They didn't say you had to take it. Oh, by the way, it's not a cancer vaccine in the way that we think of the word vaccine. No. This is for people who already have cancer. It's a treatment. And somebody told you this was the purpose of mRNA technology back in early 2020 when they already started talking about making a COVID vaccine with it. Somebody told you that it wasn't for that. Somebody told you that it was for individuals. Somebody told you that the technology was designed to actually be prepared in individual doses specifically for treating things like cancers. And it was very promising for that. Who was that someone? Some of you know who that was. It was your Uncle Jack, right? Yeah. So we'll talk about those two things and how it is good that the mainstream media dies, but then the more freedom of the press you truly have, the sharing of information. See, the press really is the sharing of information and the dissemination of information. But yellow journalism and flat-out lies take many forms. And instead of bitching about lies, you should point them out and counter them with facts. That's something that the mainstream media is absolutely incapable of. It is impossible for a known, consistent group of liars to counter claims using facts because all of their initial claims are lies. So by going into the facts, they would not just expose the lies of the people that they're opposing, but their own prior lies. There's a lesson in that. You know, your parent or your teacher or your priest or your uncle or your granddad or somebody, probably when you were a little kid, used to tell you something like, "Johnny, Mary, Susie, Tammy, Billy, if you always tell the truth, you don't have to remember what you said." There's a lesson in that. A good one to end the year on, at least for expert counsel shows. So with that, let's go ahead and drop in and listen to Dan McAdams and Dr. Ron Paul talk about weaning off the Fed the way that we weaned off the mainstream media.
We wanted to specific today, Chris, to talk about the Federal Reserve. We've talked about that because our argument has been, you know, if you're worried about deficits, just rein in the Fed. Who would buy the debt? But that would be very, very difficult, and some people would suffer that probably didn't deserve to suffer. But they're into a financial bubble, and it's hard to turn it off, and that's what they're facing up to. So, Chris, today we'd like to make a few suggestions on what we might do. Chris?
Exactly, Dr. Paul. Yeah, a lot of people ask, you know, how do you end the Fed? What do you do? Well, it is a complicated question. It's actually simple, but it's complicated. Because, well, the first step on the roadmap is education for people to understand. And more people today, thanks to Dr. Paul, understand what we're dealing with the Fed. But there's still a lot more that need to at least have an easy understanding of what the Fed is. And the Fed is a monopoly created by the government. And it's the worst type of monopoly over money. Money is a market function. It's not a monopoly created by government, but government created this monopoly bank, and it counterfeits. And if you look at the Constitution, there's only like three or four federal crimes. One of them is counterfeiting. So the government created a bank that counterfeits money. And what does it do with the counterfeit money? It buys government bonds. And that's what enables our government to expand into what has become the biggest government in the history of the world. And it has a $6 trillion budget, $36 trillion in the red. It's buried itself in debt. This was so predictable. So what do you do? Well, the easy question is, well, if they created it with the Federal Reserve Act, just repeal the Federal Reserve Act. That's the simple answer. But it's really not that simple, because the Fed has entrenched itself in our lives. It is a part of every economic transaction. It debases the money. It's the cause of the inflation. So just repealing the act, while it would be noble, it would cause a lot of harm, like Dr. Paul said. So, but in the meantime, there are things that we can do, and we're going to talk about it in the show.
And, you know, what's going on with the states, I think, is fantastic. Where the states, they know the states, the Constitution says the states can't use anything else other than gold and silver as money. So therefore, states have been motivated, and I've encouraged them, is no capital gains tax and no sales tax for buying a gold coin or a silver coin. And so that movement's on. So that's getting back to dealing with the unit of account. And I think that's where eventually the solution has to come.
One thing that came to mind for me is a model that we could use that we're living through right now. And that's the fall of the mainstream media, because that's another institution that, you know, and again, with education, people needed to be educated, and they got an education with all the lies. I mean, they just ruined their reputation and their trust. And, you know, people lie all the time, even going back to when this country was founded, the media lies. But there was, it didn't dominate. But in our lives, the lies have dominated. And especially one event that really I saw a big change around me, and this is anecdotal, is after COVID. People did not trust the media after what they were told about COVID and those vaccines. And then following with all the Trump stuff. So we had years and years and years of education about what the media really is these days, and they can't be trusted. And look at what happened to save us, you know, to use, for lack of a better term. And that's, it cost Elon $40 billion to buy X. And what that was is it's competition. Now, of course, people lie on X. People lie because people lie. But at least the truth can be found on X. If you search for it on the media, you're not going to find it, no matter how hard you search. So that's what we need with money. Competition, as Dr. Paul said, competing currencies, no more of this monopoly. And some people will still use the dollar, of course. Many people, because it's just a habit, and that's just all they know, and that's what they're comfortable with, and they don't want to change. Just like some people still, no matter how many lies are told to them, still turn on that TV and they watch the media. So people will still choose it, but there has to be competition. You have to have sound money to compete with the fiat dollar. And if we have that, we could use the fall of the media as a model to wean ourselves off of this monetary financial system that has destroyed us into something that can help us to flourish.
I have a very, very short addition to that one that I would just like you to ponder in your mind a little bit here. If you think about some of the politicians who spend the most time wailing against the banks and the billionaires, and they're on both sides of the aisle, but the two that come to my head immediately would be Bernie Sanders is once again asking for your support, and Elizabeth Pocahontas Warren, right? They're constantly telling us how evil the banks are, how evil the oligarchs are. I promise you, friends, I promise you. The day that there is a serious move to actually even consider ending the Fed or even reining it in and putting more controls on it, the day that happens, those types of politicians will be saying things like, this is a constitutional crisis, we can't get along without the Fed, we need the Fed, they have to have their independence. Whichever person is in power is a dictator. It won't matter if it's Orange Man or somebody else. You're going to hear that. Now, these are the same people that constantly tell you what? Bankers and billionaires running society is bad. Now, the thing that allows bankers and billionaires to run society more than anything else is the Federal Reserve. But they would tell you it's somehow sacred and necessary, even though we didn't even have it for the first, 100 plus years of the country. But you do with that as you will. And let's go on and talk about some free stuff from Andy McCann to help you with your fitness and diet goals going into the new year.
Hello, Survival Podcast community. This is Andy McCann here to help you with your food, fitness, and finances, mostly food and fitness. But I had some questions come out from the fall workshop. I love that, guys. Get involved. Do a thing. Show up. There are many of these self-reliance festivals that Nicole does and things that Jack does. Show up and meet people. It means so much more when you start to put faces with all the names and see people who are actually commenting in real life. Guys, get involved. Do stuff with the community. Being part of a community is huge. Okay, so this is stuff you can do. I don't know when Jack's going to air this. I give him too much material, and he has freedom to delete whatever, so I never know what's really going to come. But I had some stuff come out of the fall workshop that I did for you, and I want you to know about it. So this is not really a question. I guess the question is, Andy, what's the free stuff you have for us? So I've got free stuff for you. So the first is I mentioned to a bunch of people the 32 at-home workouts, so I'm going to link that. So there's 32 at-home workouts. Actually, as a matter of fact, for you guys, you can go to the survival... No. Take that back. You can go to crossfitgarage.com/TSPC and you are going to find all the links for you. There is the Carnivore Kickstarter, which is going to cost money, and that'll start January 18th. Like I said, I don't know when this will air. There's 60 easy. I want to go over that, the Garage Fitness Online and the podcast. But the first one is this 32 at home workouts. You can follow along in there. It's 32 workouts you can do at home. It's super easy. Do that thing, right? If you were at the workshop, you saw this already. I'm going to provide you the link. There's something that I came up with. We were joking and saying, hey, 75 hard is too hard. There should be 60 easy. So I created 60 easy. It's of the five pillars, how you eat, sleep, move, and think, and connect. It's one thing each month in 2025. There are no rules. There are one thing you can do each month on each of those, thus 60. So you can do five things each month. You can make it hard. You can make it easy. You can make it mediocre. Actually, I probably come up with 60 mediocre. And there are no rules. You can stack them. You can just do them one a month. So you could take the January one and then do it in February, March, like keep it going or not. My goal here in 60 easy was to find easy things you could do that would lead you towards some piece of better health. What I learned at the fall workshop talking to people is sometimes my advice is too high up. It's too like, yeah, I can't get there. This is easy. It's free. You can do it. I am right now going through Jack's keto journey on YouTube. It's awesome. I can't believe I missed this somehow 5 years ago. But the information is great, and I'm relearning. Things need to be made a bit easier for all of us. So 60 easy. It's eat, sleep, move, think, and connect. And one other thing I just forgot. And it's one thing each month. For example, January on eat. Start eating around the edges of the grocery store, fresh produce, meat, and dairy. So shop the edges. For sleep in January, avoid screen time 30 minutes before bedtime to improve sleep quality. I mean, it's pretty easy stuff. January for move is take a 10-minute walk after dinner each night. In January for think, do one act of kindness for someone each week. Connect, January. Practice active listening in conversation without interrupting. Woo, that's so tough. Okay, the other thing, I do have Garage Fitness Online is now available. You can find it at garagefitness.online, and it's free. So right now, for probably the foreseeable future, for like a year, I got to get this thing off the ground. So we're putting in Brandon Phillips' programming for free. So if you have a home gym or some gear, then this is for you. If you have absolutely nothing, then you want to do the 32 at-home workouts because it's gearless. This requires you to have some gear. It's when you go click on it, on the get started, it'll go to the join page, and what it's going to do is pull up a buy page There's the Alpha Tester, which is a free membership. Pick that. Do not pick the one that's paid, because it's paid. Pick the one that's free, because it's free. It'll give you a 2-month free membership. You can use that over and over and over. So you can do that for the entire year. We're probably not going to pay for it yet, because we're finding every once in a while we have a hiccup. And so minimal viable product, it's out there. It's for you guys. It's free. It's good programming. Brandon Phillips went to the games, and he's not as old as me, but he's close to maybe like 42-ish. And he does great programming to help you live that good life when times are bad or even if they're not. Obviously, we have the Carnivore Challenge. It's starting January 18th. If you sign up for that, or if it's already passed, it's not too late. You can always sign up for something. It's $100 for the normal in-class type environment. Make sure when you sign up, you also list who you heard from. If you're hearing from Jack, then put TSBC, so the credit goes to him and his audience. What other free thing I had? One other free thing for you. Oh, I know what it was. If, I know this is a big if because there are so many of you guys out there, if you will log your food for 2 weeks on some sort of app, I will talk to you for free about the big problems. No, it's not going to be like 8 hours of in-depth conversation. You'll send me, you'll give me a way to look at your stuff, and then we'll do a Zoom call together, and we'll talk about it in maybe 1 hour, right? It's to help you find those big things that you need to get done. So this is my offer for you in 2025. I have got free stuff for you. I'm listening to Jack's the keto journey, and it's just insane. It's like, how many of you won't do a thing? And he's right. I can't make it any easier. The 60 Easy and the Garage Fitness Online, there's no cost to any of those. Do these things. And I'll give you my time and support. I usually charge like $1,000 an hour because I don't like doing one-on-one. But I'll give it to you for free. Guys, I want 2025 to be awesome for you. I want your health and your fitness to be awesome. I want your finances to be awesome as well. But I think I would just do what Jack says and buy Bitcoin. But hey, I am not a financial advisor. That's just what I do. I listened to a redneck hippie duck farmer, and it turned out to be pretty good advice. Y'all take care. You can find me at in YouTube at AndyMcCann42 or on podcast. It's Fitness, Food, and Finances. Take care.
Next up, let's hear from Chef Ken Daniels. He's going to talk about, it's basically the same question driven by two different things. This one question is, you know, we did Thanksgiving. We had so many leftovers. It's just literally a problem. And so, you know, I want to avoid that, or, you know, what do I do about it? And the other question, it really is a different version of the same question, is we're not doing great economically right now, and we're hosting a big family thing, and we want to give everybody a great meal. And we don't mind spending the money that we have to, but we don't want to spend more than we need to spend. But we also want to make sure there's enough food for everybody and nobody feels like we actually are having heart, like that type of thing. So it's really sizing the meal appropriately. And let's listen to Ken, and I'll come back and see if I can add anything to it.
Hello, everyone. Ken here with DrinkEatLearn.com. With the holidays fast approaching, I've been getting a flood of questions about tips and tricks for mastering Christmas dinner. I'm thrilled by all the excitement, and next year I've decided to do an entire series dedicated to holiday kitchen survival, so that should be fun. But today there's two questions. The first question is the most asked questions I've gotten since Thanksgiving, and the second question is one that many of us may have been struggling with right now or have struggled with in the past, but it deserves to be recognized. So let's start with the first question. I really overestimated all the food we prepared for Thanksgiving. I had leftovers for days, and we ended up throwing some out. I'm expecting another family gathering for Christmas. Any tips on how to get this right? And that came from Chris. Second question, Anonymous asks, I'm embarrassed to say that money has been tight this year. It's not like we're down and out, just watching every penny and trying to not let the kids feel the pain. I especially do not want the in-laws to know that we are struggling. We've been good at saving for Christmas, so we've budgeted a good amount of money for our extended family's Christmas dinner. I'm just not a pro at how much to buy. Can you help? Yeah, I mean, this one pulls at the heartstring. It's the kind of shit you never hear on Food Network. Life is good, but some years are harder than others. So a big thank you for being honest in your question. And I want to answer both of these questions with some tips to be smarter when buying these dinners. Sure, you can do things like potlucks and assigning dish to family members, and that can help spread the cost around. But let's approach this like adults, right? I want everyone to be fed. I want it to feel like a bountiful feast for Christmas. I don't want to run out of food. I'd like to have some leftovers. But at some point, there's prudent prepping for your guest, and then there's just irrational thinking. And all leftovers are great, but there's only so many turkey sandwiches that I can personally eat. Plus, the worst feeling is dumping wasted food and money from a Tupperware into the trash bin. So let's think back to last month, Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving, the turkey was the star of the table. And now for Christmas dinner, based on your traditions, you might have any one of the following combinations on your table. Ham, turkey, duck, goose, maybe even prime rib. So portions can be somewhat of a mystery to many, and overbuying means overspending. So let's break it down. Proteins. For bone-in meats like turkey, ham, prime rib, plan for 1 to 1.5 pounds per adult, and about 3/4 of a pound per child. Now that's for bone-in. For boneless options like beef tenderloin, boneless turkey breast, even pork loin, I would aim for about 1/2 to 3/4 of a pound per adult and about 1/4 of a pound per child. So let's say you've got 8 adults, 4 kids. You're looking at about a 12 to 15 pound turkey or a 7 to 10 pound ham. You should just be about right. Now, if you're planning on having both turkey and ham, I'd divide those numbers in half. So roughly a 6 pound turkey, 4 pounds of ham. If you know your family likes more ham, then adjust accordingly. And if you're having turkey, ham, and prime rib, first invite me over for dinner. But secondly, make sure that you spread the cost over the 3 smaller proteins. Let's move on to sides. Let's talk about mashed potatoes. A serving size is roughly 8 ounces per adult and 4 ounces per child. So how many damn potatoes does that actually mean? Well, shopping in the produce section of your grocery store, there are these things called scales everywhere, and we're going to try to use them. A good ratio is 1/2 pound of raw potatoes makes about 1 cup of mashed potatoes. So if you've got 8 adults, 4 kids, based on the portions, you'll need about 10 cups of mashed potatoes to feed them. That comes out to about 5 pounds of raw potatoes. You want some extra potatoes? Sure, add 1 pound. You're living in a keto carnivore house? Calculate down based on 4 ounce portions and use less potatoes. As for the veggies, you're aiming for the same serving size of about 8 ounces per adult and 4 ounces per child. Remember, veggies all combine, right? So if you've got carrots, corn, and green beans, you're still looking at a combined 1 cup per person. However, if you've got access to produce on a homestead or there's a good sale at the grocery store, this is where you can make your dinner look like a feast for a lot less money. End up making 2 or 3 different vegetable dishes. It really looks good on the table. Okay, bread roll, simple, 1 to 2 per person. Butter, 1 stick, which is about 4 ounces for every 8 people. Unsalted, remove it from the fridge about 1 hour before service. Dessert, estimate about 1 piece of pie per person. There's 8 slices to a pie. Do the math. You can easily make it into smaller pieces, like 16 pieces. If money's tight, buy apple, peach, or cherry, and then add some inexpensive value brand vanilla ice cream. Okay? Let's talk kids. I've gave the estimate portion for the kids, but you know your kids' eating habits. If you want a way to feed the kids without buying more expensive meat, check out Last Expert Counsel or DrinkEatLearn.com. About the Christmas mashed potato pizza could be a good option to save some money. Lastly, if you're trying to save money and stretch the expensive items like meats, instead of serving everything on the table at once, consider using a home buffet line. Think of like a Congo line in the kitchen, right? Arrange your buffet to fill plates wisely. Start the buffet line with the sides, like a salad, mashed potatoes, veggies, then place pricier items like turkey and ham towards the end of the line. The plate space has been filled up with the veggies and starch, less room for meat. Use smaller spoons and forks for each dish on the buffet line instead of large serving spoons. That can help with portion control. If you've been working hard on cooking all these beautiful cuts of meat, carving the meat on the line and serving portions to your guest directly, if done right, it looks fancy, like asking for dark or white meat. This keeps Uncle Asshole and Aunt Karen from loading up a $25 of prime rib only to throw half of it in the bin, right? Look, I remember times in my life when money was very limited. These holiday dinners cost money and Christmas is expensive enough. There's no shame in trying to save money because times are tough, or even if they're not. And this is what this community is here for. I hope you approach Christmas dinner with confidence. Smart planning means less stress, less waste, definitely less money spent, and you'll still get plenty of leftovers. By the way, every day until Christmas, I'll be answering more questions and providing recipes and basic holiday survival tips, helping you prepare the best holiday feast for your friends and family on DrinkEatLearn.com. Come check us out. Again, until next time, this is Ken with DrinkEatLearn.com. Cheers and Merry Christmas.
So let me throw a few additions in here, and I also want to make sure that we're not making anybody feel uncomfortable with decisions about a holiday meal because of our talk about health. So obviously, if you had your druthers and you could do anything you want, you had a magic wand, then your turkey would be a beautiful pastured turkey. And that will cost you anywhere, you know, well, right now you're not getting one unless you already have one arranged, but it will cost you anywhere between $100 and $250, depending on the size of the bird and how purely that bird was raised and how desirable it is and everything else. If you go to the grocery store, you can pick up a butterball and a fairly large bird that would feed, you know, an extended family, you know, will be in the range of $60 to $70 now. Thank you, inflation. But if you were to pick up, like, the generic brand, which probably was raised the exact same way the butterball was, they're selling right now for about 97 cents a pound, meaning you can buy a 20-pound bird, which is huge, you can buy that for about $20. And in most states, anyway, there's not, since it's not prepared and it's food, there's not even sales tax on it. So it's really like $19.90-something for a 20-pound turkey. So that right there would give you a bunch of meat really, really inexpensively. Potatoes are one of the best values for money even today. And doing something like two different potatoes, and I know I'm the keto guy, blah, blah, blah. And I've said, and at Thanksgiving and Christmas and certain holiday parties, I don't give a shit. And so this year I did mashed potatoes because we have to do mashed potatoes. But I also did smashed potatoes. And they are not what some people call smashed potatoes. What I did is I took little, like, fingerling-sized potatoes, different color ones, purples and golds and reds, and I boiled them skin on. And then I let them cool completely down in the refrigerator overnight. Then I took them and I smashed them, but I didn't make them into a mash. Just flat-out smashed them like into medallions. So the edge puffed out. And I used beef tallow and salt, pepper, and some like Italian seasoning on those. And I threw them in the oven just before we were going to serve so that they kind of crisped up around the edges and got nice and hot. People killed those. Like, they killed those harder than mashed potatoes. And my family, especially my extended family, are mashed potato fiends. I want to tell you, there was no mashed potato leftovers this year. And that's how, and my wife made a bunch of them. And they still went nuts over the smashed potatoes. So just two potatoes, very inexpensive, feeds a lot of people two different ways. All of a sudden you have something going on a little bit more. Two, instead of buying gravy in packets, make your own gravy. You already have the turkey or the roast. And I'm not going to go into exactly how to make a gravy right now, but basically you make a roux and you make a stock. And you combine them and you make gravy. And it's essentially free, other than like the butter you use as your fat in your roux and a little bit of flour. So that's cheap. All right, so those are some ways to keep costs down. I'll give you one more way. If you go out and you buy a prime rib, great, if you can afford it, and it's delicious. But if you go out and buy an eye around, you cut the ends off of it, tie it up so it's nice and uniform, and cook it to an internal temperature of about 135 degrees up to maybe 138 at the highest, which means you're going to kill the heat and let it come up to that temperature and really give it some time. And you serve that as your beef. It will cost you freaking 20% of what a prime rib will, and no one, trust me, I've done this, no one will complain about it. And I think if you go back to the one that Ken's talking about where he gave the recipe for the pizza, I think that's where I actually go through how I make an eye of round. So those are some cost savings on the front end of buying things. On the back end, because sometimes it's not so much, I don't want to spend so much, but I don't want to waste what we have. The number one thing I can advise you to reduce your waste around holiday meals that involve poultry, like a goose, duck, big chicken, like a capon, a turkey, etc., is don't cook your bird whole, which is a good practice anyway. Take your breasts off, take your leg quarters off, part the bird out, cook the bird like that. And what I did this year is I took my two breast halves and I inverted them. So fat side, skinny side, touching each other, skin on the outside, excess skin pulled off the back, wrapped around it, tied it up into a roast, and I made that breast like a giant breast roast. I basically made a giant breast roast out of it. Cook that, you know, to your preferred temperature. For me, that's about 150 degrees with carryover, and then set it aside. Like, what I do is I wrap them up and I put them in a cooler. And that keeps them warm for hours, and it continues to cook without the temperature coming up much from where you're at. And what that does is it tenderizes without overcooking. But here's the real beauty of parting it out. So now we take the core and all the scraps, and we throw that in the oven, we brown it, we throw it in a stock pot, we make stock. That's your gravy base. You got that? Okay. You take your bones and you toss them. But here's the beauty. When everybody's done with dinner, instead of a turkey roasting pan full of jello from the hardened fat and bones, and you're just like, I am tired, I worked all day, I don't want to do anything, you've got the bird parted out. What's left of the breast is easily sliced and put away. And if it's more than you're going to use with leftovers for the week, then break it into smaller packages, vacuum seal it, and toss it in the freezer on the day after the meal, instead of leaving it sit in the refrigerator, and then it won't go to waste. Most of the other, and then you do the same thing with your meats. If you have beef or ham or whatever, break it up into portion sizes that you'll actually use as leftovers in the future and get it in the freezer right away in an organized manner, and then make a conscious effort to eat it over the next several 3 weeks or so. Okay? And then none of it goes to waste. And now, even though you spent the money there, you're actually cutting the cost in the future. And when we make these big bulky items, like a roast, like a turkey, etc., we actually pay a lot less per meal when you really think about it. That's why it was done in the first place. So those are just some additions that I have to that, and hopefully those will help you. Moving on, let's now hear from John Pugliano about saving to buy a house with some creative thinking about that, along with what an accredited investor is, and does it even, you know, does it matter if you are one or not?
Hello, TSP. I have a couple investing questions to answer. The first one comes from Zach. Here's Zach's question. If you were me and you wanted to build a house in a few years, would you pile money into a Roth 401k fully invested after 2 years with very generous employer contributions and with expectations that you can pull the money out in a few years under the rules of a special hardship distribution for house construction? Zach goes on to give a number of details, and I think he has a pretty good handle on exactly the match from his employer, which is very generous. And I think generally his logic is accurate, that if he took an early withdrawal, even with taxes and perhaps penalties, he'd still come out ahead because of the generous contribution from his employer. There are a couple caveats to that. That's what I wanted to fill in the blanks on. Number one, Zach, in your question, you specifically mentioned piling money into a Roth 401k. Keep in mind that while you can put your personal employee contributions into the Roth 401k, matches or contributions from the employer cannot be deposited on the Roth side of the 401k. They have to go into the traditional 401k category. Now, that's not a big deal in your case, but just keep that in mind. The other thing to think about in your calculations, because you mentioned having to pay maybe up to 30% in taxes and penalties, that 10% early withdrawal penalty wouldn't apply if, in fact, you can really use the hardship ruling for an early distribution. And then in terms of the Roth 401k, again, this is where there's a nuance in the tax code. There's a difference in the distribution rulings from a Roth 401k versus just a regular IRA 401k. In your normal self-contributing to a Roth IRA, 100% of your contributions can be taken out early without tax or penalty. That isn't entirely true when it comes to a Roth 401k. And that's because employers and custodians of Roth 401ks are not required to segregate and keep track of contributions versus capital gains. And so any early distribution from a Roth 401k, even if it's only up to the amount that you personally contributed to it, there would still potentially be some taxes due because it's going to prorate any gains that you have into your contribution. I know this is hard to understand talking in an audio format like this, but trust me, there are differences and nuances between Roth 401ks and just simple regular Roth IRAs. In any case, back to your specific question. You mentioned a hardship distribution, and most people don't realize that a hardship distribution can include early penalty-free withdrawals that relate to housing costs. And this is separate and aside from the $10,000 that can be taken out by first-time home purchasers. And so as far as an early penalty-free distribution from a 401k, the IRS states that costs directly related to the purchase of an employee's principal residence can be considered as an immediate and heavy financial need. So that doesn't include mortgage payments, but it potentially would relate to expenses covered to buying a home or purchasing a home to pay for closing costs, down payment, inspection fees, and similar type expenses. But I do want to mention here, I'm not a tax professional. I'm not giving you specific advice. I'm just reviewing your question and giving you some ideas to think about. As you pursue this, I'd encourage you to seek specific personal tax advice on this. But again, overall, I do think your logic is sound. Okay, next question comes from Andrew. and he's asking what he needs to do to get accredited as an investor, and are there any downsides? Okay, so as far as being an accredited investor, no, there's not any downsides. I mean, you either are or you're not. The term accredited investor is a regulatory status or a regulatory term. I believe it comes directly from the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission. It's a designation that's supposed to identify or categorize a sophisticated investor. And a sophisticated investor, meaning that this is someone that should be mature and shrewd enough to be able to determine if they're making wise investment choices. And so the reason this is designated this way is to prohibit those in the financial business, the people that Jack would call financial liars, it's to prohibit them or to try and restrict them from taking advantage of unsuspecting consumers. So it's a worthy attempt. It's designed to keep unsuspecting, gullible investors from getting fleeced. However, like most things dealing with government regulation, is that it's really just a marketing ploy. And let's relate this to how Andrew just asked his question. He specifically asked, how does he become an accredited investor? So somewhere through some marketing, someone has convinced him that it's a good idea to be an accredited investor. And the reason for that is a lot of investments are marketed as being exclusive or being designed for, you know, you've seen those ads. You know, this is how billionaires make their money, and now you can join in on the secret. Now, that doesn't mean that every investment that requires the participation of accredited investors is a scam. I mean, that's not the case at all, but just be aware that when you see that term, a red flag should go up. I've met a number of people over the years that have had a great deal of buyer's remorse where they got involved in alternative investments that they had no idea what it was. It was extremely hard to get out of. There are early redemption fees associated with a lot of these type investments. And what a lot of people have found out the hard way is, even once they're eligible to sell and get out of the investment, they find out that it's so illiquid that unless they're willing to sell for an extremely low discount, they really can't get out of it anyways. In a lot of ways, you can think of these type investments as being sold unscrupulously, like you would something like a vacation timeshare. In any case, getting back to the actual question, what do you have to do? Well, again, you don't do anything. It's just what you are. You have to have a net worth of at least $1 million, and that doesn't include the value of your primary residence, right? This is liquid assets available to you in excess of $1 million. If you don't have that, you have to have income, I believe it's of at least $200,000 a year, and as a couple, it would be at least $300,000. And if you don't meet either of those two requirements, you could also be considered an accredited investor if you possess some type of industry certification or something recognized by the, you know, financial industry as a professional qualification. All right, Andrew also has another question. He asks if my views have changed on Bitcoin since it's been transacted over ham radio since 2019. Well, Andrew, I can honestly say of all the things that have shaped my views and opinions on Bitcoin, the fact that it can be transmitted over ham radio has never even been a consideration as to whether I would be pro or con against it. Hey, in any case, last thing here real quick, a lot of the post-election enthusiasm is starting to fade and come out of the market. People are coming to the realization that inflation isn't under control. And now that there's a Trump presidency, again, I don't think it's any surprise, but the Federal Reserve has all of a sudden not been so gung-ho to cut interest rates, and we've seen the market pulling back as a result of that. So listen, I take all this with a grain of salt. I think there are a lot of solid long-term trends built into the market. I'd encourage you, if you haven't already seen it, to go look at the presentation that I did at Jack's Fall Workshop. He has it up on his YouTube channel. It's under Live Presentations. I've received a lot of good comments and questions about that. And I think there's some good information there that blends into long-term trends and specifically how that may mesh with the Trump presidency. Well, hey, as always, I appreciate the questions. I'd like to wish everybody at TSP a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And especially, I'd like to thank Jack and Dorothy for everything they do for all of us and the entire TSP community. Until next year, this is John Pugliano from Investable Wealth and the Wealthsteading Podcast.
So when I put these shows together, I do try to listen to the expert council members, but I also multitask. So if John did also give this other qualifier to be an accredited investor, and I'm repeating it. It's not that I'm a dumbass. I just, while I was multitasking, I didn't hear him say this, and I wanted to make sure that it got put into this. You can be an accredited investor, like John says, net worth over $1 million, or certain certifications, but it also can be done strictly from an income standpoint. If you have an income exceeding $200,000 per annum, and that doesn't mean your revenue, that's what you pay tax on. If you pay tax on more than $200,000 in income a year, you are considered an accredited investor. If you are a couple and you file jointly, then it has to be over $300,000 if you're adding your spouse's income. If you are a couple filing jointly, but your income exceeds the $200,000, you are an accredited investor. Your spouse is not. If you combine the income to over $300,000, let's say you both make a buck and a half a piece exactly, then you're both. It's again, it's the government trying to help, and whenever the government tries to help, I just think of the words of Ronald Reagan, and if I have to tell you what those are, I'm not going to do it today. You can look it up for yourself about government helping you and Ronald Reagan's quote about it. Anyway, with that, let's move on. I also say that I think it does more harm than good, but it also probably does protect some people from themselves. But what it really does, these laws on accredited investors, is make sure that the best investments that are available aren't available to the people who don't have a lot of money who could most benefit from those investments. On the other side of it, there's a lot of scammy shit that the government's like, hey, you got enough money. If you want to piss it away, that's okay. So you take that as you will. Let's go on and hear from Ken Berry about going on carnivore and having heart palpitations. This does happen. And in fact, happened to my wife when we first went keto.
Hey, Jack Spearco and the TSP crew. This is Dr. Ken Berry answering a question from Tyler today. Tyler tried carnivore a few months back, liked it for the health benefits, felt better and lost weight. Those are all good signs that that's a proper human diet. My problem, though, is I was getting heart palpitations where it kind of flutters, feels like it misses a beat. I don't like the feeling of that, kind of scary. So this happens to some people, and the vast majority of people it happens to are people who are not minding their electrolytes and minding their salt intake. When you're eating a high-carb diet, it causes you to hold anywhere from 5 to 25 pounds of extra water on your body. And when you start keto, meat-heavy keto, ketovore or carnivore, you're going to diurese out this unhealthy water that you were storing unnecessarily. With that water, because of the way the human kidney is designed, you're going to lose electrolytes and salt. That's not a problem of the diets. That's the way human physiology works. And so definitely during the transition process, you're going to have to prioritize getting extra salt and extra electrolytes, the two most common being magnesium and potassium, in your diet. You're going to have to go out of your way to get that for at least a few weeks, if not a month or two, while you're converting to this way of eating. Now, some people keep supplementing electrolytes and salting their food to taste. Other people find over time that they no longer really have to worry about that stuff, that it kind of takes care of itself. But this is almost assuredly what was happening to you. You were getting low on one of the electrolytes. They're very inexpensive electrolyte supplements. There's actually many videos about how to make your own electrolyte supplement at home, and it's going to cost you about 3 cents a day if you do that, whereas some of the other electrolyte supplements are very expensive. So if money's an issue, make your own. It's really easy, I promise. But that's probably what was happening to Tyler and many other people who abruptly adopt a carnivore diet and not think about salt and electrolyte. This is Dr. Berry. Hope this helps. Talk to you guys next time.
So this absolutely did occur for my wife, and at the same time we were doing vitamin D and K2 supplementation, and we found some research that there were different types of K2 and that some of the K2 caused this. We did make that switch, but we also went to using more electrolytes and salt, and one way or another that issue went away. So I guess those are two things that both have a history, but I believe it is more likely that it was insufficient salt and electrolytes due to the water drop when we initially went on the diet. And I would advise anybody to use a good quality salt. And I think one of the reasons this happens is, well, two. I think there's two primary reasons. One, it's just not something people really think about. But two is we have been scared of salt by the people that have made us believe that fat makes us fat and that we need lots of carbohydrates. And those are the same people that led us into a type 2 diabetes epidemic, a metabolic syndrome epidemic, an obesity epidemic. By the way, a low vitamin D epidemic, because when you're obese, you're going to have low vitamin D levels. Ask me how I know. So those are the same people that told you all the other things you now know are a lie. What do you think that means about the last one, that salt is bad for you? Salt is not bad for you. People do not overeat salt. I don't care what the TV tells you. People have a natural amount of salt that they will add to their food, and then they have a level beyond that that they won't because it makes the food taste like shit. So if you're using salt with your food and you're not afraid of it, you're probably not going to have this problem, though some electrolyte supplementation beyond just salt may be a good idea, at least until your body moves over. Remember that when we go from any diet to any other diet, we're going to have some adaptability issues over time. It's going to take time to change what the body has been accustomed to. And you're going to have some negative consequences. And when you get off carbs, especially if your diet's been primarily carbs, and most people it is, because carbs that we think in our head anyway are cheap. They're really not, but we think they are. The body's adapted to that. Even if it's not doing well with it, it has adapted to it. Now you're asking it to adapt to something else, and it's going to flush that water that your body's retaining. And for some people, that can be, 10 pounds, 20 pounds of their initial weight loss over their first month or two can be mostly water. And that's why critics will say it's not real. Well, your body's not supposed to be walking around with that much retained water. It's not good for you. But your body adapted to it, and it's using it as an electrolyte storage because it's got to do something with it. And electrolytes are water soluble. So when you flush it, you flush a great deal of those electrolytes until your body adapts. So I use salt on my food all the time. I've never had this problem at all. I've never had anything like this occur to me during my adaptation. But just remember, it's not just this. That when you come off carbohydrates, you are coming off a drug. Your body has become accustomed to sugar as a drug. And now you're taking it away. And it's likely the case that for most people, specifically people who really need to lose weight, you're going to have something happen that you don't like. And just like you wouldn't tell a heroin addict who's getting off heroin, or a meth addict who's getting off meth and says, or an alcoholic who's drank every day of their life and their first day without drinks has, maybe not enough to go to the hospital, but like a mild case of DTs or withdrawals or shakes, or they just don't feel good, you wouldn't say, well, you know what the solution is? Go back to using your drug of choice and just keep doing it because this didn't work for you. You'd say, we have to get you through this. Even if you need some medical intervention to get through it, we need to get you through this so you can put this behind you. That's what you're doing when you come off carbohydrates. And I don't care if you're going to be the person that eats 50 to 100 carbohydrates a day if we're not doing the net carb thing. Like if we're just going to, that's actually low carb compared to what the average American consumes, because most of the data you find is a lie. And the reason I mean that it's a lie is that the statistics you'll see will break carbohydrates and sugar into two different things. They'll say that this is the sugar, and what they mean is pure sugar, added sugar. The 2 teaspoons you put in your coffee because you're a freak. I don't know how anybody drinks coffee like that. The added sugar that's in the fruit juice, but they're not counting the sugar that's in the fruit juice from the fruit itself. They put that in the category of carbohydrate. So when you look, you'll see these statistics of sugar grams that a person consumes and carbohydrate grams that a person consumes. If you want the real average across society, you have to combine those two numbers. And you can't trust them independently of each other unless you verify where the number came from, actually combine them. Because a carbohydrate is a carbohydrate is a carbohydrate. A carbohydrate from an apple, a carbohydrate from a potato, and a carbohydrate from pure table sugar, metabolically to the body, is the same. And I don't care who tells you otherwise. And if you've ever made distilled alcohol, you know that's true. Anyway, with that, let's move on. And we have our next one. From our newest expert council member, Ryan Steva, the Homestead Consultant, he wants to talk to you about the magic of direct solar and how you can use it.
Hey, Jack and TSP community. This is Ryan Stevo with thehomesteadconsultant.com, and I wanted to bring a concept into the forefront that I think is one of the most overlooked and neglected concepts in modern homesteading as well as in modern preparedness, and that's the idea of direct solar systems. So we probably all know that solar systems have come way down in cost and gone way up in their capabilities. But one of the things that makes it still too expensive or not feasible for the average person is the cost and complexity. Now, if we removed batteries, inverters, and charge controllers from that system, it would dramatically reduce the cost and complexity of those systems. So there is a way to do this, and I want to seed the idea into the conscience of the greater community, because I think that there's a lot of missed opportunity here, and I would love to hear and talk more about different ways that we could use these systems. But I want to give a really brief overview of a few of the bullet points, and I've got pages of bullet points of potential uses, but a few of the bullet points to give you an idea of what you could be doing with these systems. And then I also want to give a nugget, because one of the issues with these systems is I think that people don't know some of the terminology and some of the things that they need to know to get these systems off the ground. And I want to give you one piece of information that I think is going to unlock the whole thing for you in being feasible and helping you make this system work. But I think I need to explain some of the pros and cons and potential use cases so that this whole thing makes sense together. So first of all, the pros of a direct solar system are that they're inexpensive. Generally, they're easy to set up. They have minimal equipment that's needed. They provide power in remote locations, oftentimes when it's most needed. For example, if you've got a chicken coop that doesn't have power, you can set it up so it ventilates the chicken coop or shed or other things only when the sun's out, because that's when a fan's going to run directly off of a solar panel. You can do the same with water pumps and store the water uphill. So you can store the water in a container uphill when the sun's shining. Basically, now you have a gravity-fed water battery system. So you can use that at night or other times when the sun's not shining. Another pro is that they're generally safer for the do-it-yourselfer because they're lower voltage, less potential for harm. It can be decentralized and used in multiple locations on the same property or on a remote property as well. It's portable and it can store energy in creative ways. So even though we are typically not going to be running major battery systems with it, there are some creative ways that we can store the energy that we do produce. So the cons to the system are that it is going to have inconsistent power. It's not going to run 120 volt or 240 volt systems that you would typically see in a household because the power is inconsistent. It's also hard to find good setup information, which is where I'm trying to break that barrier for people in this quick explanation. In general preparedness, as well as powering in remote locations, here are just a handful of many, many ideas that I have and have used in the past. So you can power lights, especially rechargeable lights like flashlights or other lanterns. You can charge communications equipment, such as phones, ham radios, GMRS, routers, Starlink, and so much more. You can power a 12-volt diesel heater, which are incredibly inexpensive, very efficient, and a great way of keeping your house or other locations warm when power is out. You can charge cars, mowers, motorcycles, ATVs. You can run backup water pumps, air pumps, compressors, inflators. You can also run fans, especially for something like a greenhouse. It will run only when you need it to, which is when the sun is out. You can also charge power tool batteries, which I think are one of the most overlooked preparedness devices. Anything that's USB, you can charge with these systems. The USB battery packs that Jack talks about, the Anker battery packs that are fairly large, you can run a heated blanket off of those. You can run a heated jacket off of those. So you can actually keep yourself warm both outside or during a power outage with this direct solar system. It can also be used for remote radio repeaters. So if you have a radio repeater at the top of the hill, you can use direct solar to recharge a specialized battery bank that will keep that repeater running. You can also run well pumps, spring pumps or other water pumps. You can run an electric fence. You can run chicken doors. You can even run a wood curing station where you use a radiator fan to pull air through your stacked firewood to help it cure more quickly. You can run a solar dehydrator and so many more things. I really can't get into all of them, but there are so many potential applications. So here's the secret sauce. It's called a buck converter. They are a simple DC to DC converter, so they will take a range of DC voltage as the input, and then they will actually output a specific voltage based on what you choose. In my case, my favorite output voltage is the 13.8 volts. And the reason for that is that almost all 12-volt listed items are intended to be run at a higher voltage, so closer to that 13.8 volts. Typically between about 14 volts and 12 volts is what 12-volt items are actually intended to be used at. And so the 13.8 volts is basically perfect for anything that's listed for use in a car, a cigarette lighter, or an RV. And so all those devices that are intended to run off of those systems will run perfectly on the 13.8 volts. The other reason for a buck converter with an output of 13.8 volts is that that is the perfect level to float charge a car battery or an ATV battery, or pretty much any lead acid or sealed lead acid battery that you're going to run across, as well as most gel batteries and some other batteries as well. So most of this system hinges on a very inexpensive buck converter, my favorite of which is a 30 to 60 volt input buck converter with a output voltage of 13.8 volts. And generally speaking, I like those between 10 and 30 amps, depending on my circumstance and my input panel. But that is really all there is to it. So it's a panel, a buck converter, and then you may have a cigarette lighter or other way of adapting that 12-volt nominal voltage coming out of the buck converter to work with a USB charger or other 12-volt devices that are intended for cars or RVs. So I hope that gives you some information and inspiration to start doing this yourself. And I'd be happy to cover any questions that people have on these systems. Thanks so much for listening. And if you need anything from me, you can find my information at thehomesteadconsultant.com.
Like I said, I think he's going to be a fantastic addition to the expert council. He actually sent me three segments as an audition, and the other two are really great too. But if you have questions for him, send them on over. I don't know that he'll fill all of the roles that Sean has done in the past, but I think we have someone else that might be able to fit in, and then that way we kind of have some load sharing there. But that was a great segment. And he's right, direct solar is something we should think about more. One of the things to think about, though, is like how to really make the most of it. So if you have like a large water source and you can pump water by day, upgrade some sort of storage tank, yeah, that's great and all. But what you have to think about is then you need some way to shut that pump down. And so you need some way that the other side is managed by a float valve that basically says stop. Because the way most pumps run on a float valve is when the sump that they're sitting in gets too low, they shut off. So you got to kind of reverse that, or you can put it in a return line. And so that water's constantly filling up and overflowing and returning back to your source. That would keep the water fresh. And, you know, at night when it stops running, it just stops returning. So there's other ways to handle it. But there's a lot of different cool ways that we can use direct solar. Like his idea with a fan and a chicken coop is great. And it's less keeping it cool, and it's more keeping it well ventilated and keeping gases out of it and, you know, keeping it dry, too, by moving air. If you do have some buildup of some moisture, you help dry off that air, that moisture. I've actually been running. Now, there's power to my coop, but I've been running a fan in the early half of the day for the past couple of days, because I had some straw that I added in the last deep litter edition that got, it's not wet, but it's damp. It's damper than it should be, but I was like, it's what I have. It's what you're getting. We're making compost next month anyway. And so that's been really helpful as well. Anyway, moving on, let's hear from Nicole Sauce, following up on my segment from a couple weeks ago about not waiting till New Year's to start now. And why now is always the time to start. And if you don't look at it that way, you'll always find a reason that now's not a good time.
Hey, TSP, Nicole Sauce here from the Living Free in Tennessee podcast and Holler Roast Coffee, coming to you with an expert segment. And this is not in response to a question. I actually heard Jack talking about getting control of your diet on his show and not waiting until January to start. And that got me to thinking about a time I did that. I just wanted to share the story with you if you're still on the fence about getting off your butt and making a real change in your life. So at this time of year, we are turning the corner mentally between December 31st and January 1st, even though the new year is just basically a date we've chosen on the calendar, which we are programmed to think, our perspective is programmed to think of January as this new thing, right? And between now and then we have Christmas, and it's a really hard time of year to do something like take control of your diet and exercise, isn't it? Because you're busy, you're driving places, you're worried about getting all the presents to your kids, like all of the parties, Nutcracker to go see, all of the good things. Well, here's the thing, guys. You're turning a corner mentally, whether you want to or not, at the end of this month. It's happening. And I remember about a year and a half ago, I was feeling like I couldn't lose weight and I wasn't very disciplined in what I was doing. And I'd heard about this thing called 75 Hard. And I was like, well, let's see. In 3 weeks, I'm going to go to Exit and Build Land Summit, and I'm going to see Jack, and we're going to go out to dinner probably, and I'm going to want an alcoholic beverage, but 75 Hard says no alcohol, so I'll start right after that. And I was like, oh yeah, but then it's his like 15th anniversary, less than 75 days from there, so I'll wait till after. Oh no, now we're running into Self-Reliance Festival, and I always had an excuse. And I sat there with that. It was just, this all happened in one day. And I thought, you know what? If I really want to make a change in my life, what I need to do is just start now. And what's going to be hard, the hard in 75 hard is going to be when I go to Exit and Build Land Summit and my two buddies are there and we are going out to eat. And there is a 007 martini on the menu, by the way. That is what happened. And I say no, thank you. And I have carbonated water with lime in it, like I always do when I'm not drinking alcohol and I'm out. That's going to be the hard part. It's not going to be the exercising twice a day. It's not going to be anything else. That's going to be the hard part. Now, I finished 75 hard successfully, and it made a huge physical difference for me, but the mental difference was most important. And it turned out the hardest part for me was, in fact, drinking the gallon of water, because some days my body doesn't need a gallon of water. But it was also not easy that first time when the 007 martini was on the menu and it looked really nice to say no to that. But no is what I said. And I ate a delicious dinner full of delicious meat and stayed disciplined that whole time. And if I hadn't made that choice, if I hadn't decided to prioritize myself first, I would be in a very different physical condition right now. But more importantly, my business wouldn't be as good and my mental state wouldn't be as good. And I wouldn't be getting better at delivering on things that I promised to do, because my primary concern was that. So you already know, if you're listening to this and we've captured your attention with this whole, hey, take control of your health thing, right? You already know you want to be better. You want to be healthier. You know you want to do something to be healthier. Or you wouldn't be thinking about that New Year's resolution. You already know you want to be wealthier in 2005. You already know you want to be more prepared for the real things that are going to happen. You already know you want your relationships to be better. So what you have to ask yourself is this. What are you going to do to prioritize yourself and just start? Because what you're talking about here right now is, are you going to sacrifice yourself to bad habits or to other external things that you can't control? Or are you going to prioritize yourself and build in some accountability and start to eat the way you should eat, get rid of the seed oils, find a way to build exercise into every morning when you get up, which will set a foundation for you to be healthier, wealthier, more mentally stable, more prepared for things that will happen. And then when Christmas comes, in about 7 days from now. You know what? Eat the cake, have the chocolate, eat the mashed potatoes, and then give away all the treats people gave you the next day and keep on trucking. Make the decision to prioritize yourself. Make it now before you mentally transition into next year, because you know what that means? That means you're bringing the good into that mental transition that is already programmed into your brain. That means you're starting out good. You're not going in with the bad and then I'm going to change. You already started changing. You already started your journey, and that's really important. Maybe even have those drinks on New Year's Eve. Maybe drink a little less if you were planning to drink a lot. But make the transition with the change already in place and look at it like a lifestyle change. I think no is the hardest part of this transition, because a lot of people don't understand or support some of these lifestyle changes we make, especially people who are used to feeling bad. They want you to feel bad with them. I know it sounds mean, but we're like a herd mentality species, right? And when people go off and do something different and do take control of their lives, you can get a lot of negative Nellies. So starting yourself now sets you up mentally to go through the transition of the new year and just make it happen no matter what happens. And if you're willing to go hardcore right now, then start something like 75 hard, if that's what you want to do. And on Christmas, don't drink the alcohol and don't eat the chocolate and just stick to a healthy whole foods diet. That's fine too. I find that if I want a treat that's of the baked variety, it's a really good control for me that I have to bake it myself, because then I'm a whole lot less likely to make the time to do that, right? Make space for yourself, prioritize yourself. I encourage you to do exactly what Jack said and start, and then know that the hard part about prioritizing yourself is prioritizing yourself through anything that happens. But you can do it. If I can do it, because I'm a lazy person by nature, if I can do it, you can certainly do it. Also, if you haven't finished getting all your gifts yet, head over to hollowroast.com and check out what we've got. We're almost out of the bean barrel. We might be out of it by the time this show airs. And we've still got some Jack's Bourbon Cooled Sumatra, and I was able to source a second bag of that. So get that before it sells out over at hollowroast.com. With that, Merry Christmas, and make it a great week.
Yeah, you know, I completely agree, because I am just not that guy that is going to be a purist on my diet around certain occasions. Now, I want to say some other side of that. Okay, Thanksgiving happens once a year. Christmas happens once a year. New Year's happens once a year. They all happen to be pretty close to each other. If you're in a family that's a big family that does everything together, that's the place you can't do this, where, but it's so-and-so's birthday, and it's so-and-so's birthday, and it's so-and-so, and every 2-3 weeks, somebody else is having a fucking birthday, or a celebration, or an anniversary. Like, if you're in a family like that, where they're throwing food at you every week, or every other week, and it's cake with icing and shit, that's where you have to say no thank you. And this is how it'll go. Oh, but it's just, I just don't really want a piece right now. Don't say it's because of your diet. I just don't really want a piece right now. And you might get a little bit of pressure, and then pretty soon everybody's shoving cake in their cake hole, and you become forgotten about. And pretty soon they stop asking. Again, ask me how I know, right? But if you always say, but, you know, on this day I'm going to do this thing, then do the thing on that day. And don't do the thing the day before and the next day, because you're going to do it on that day anyway, and go on with life. All right, so let's get into my stuff. I want to talk about a couple things right now that are being handled really poorly by, you know, people that see themselves as independent journalists and influencers, thought leaders on social media, especially X. And they have to do with Bitcoin, and they have to do with Russia's cancer vaccine. I want to start out on the Bitcoin thing with one I didn't think of that I want to throw in this real quick, just to point something out that, and this really isn't being handled wrong, it's just maybe not being understood right. So Donald Trump has said that the United States is going to implement a Bitcoin reserve when he takes office. Now, there's people saying they can't do it, whatever. And Jerome Powell of the Federal Reserve was asked about it, and he said the Federal Reserve cannot implement a Bitcoin reserve, and he even referenced a part of the code that the Federal Reserve operates under that says what it can and cannot buy as a commodity reserve. Now, there's two things about this that are a problem. I'll get to the second one in a second, which just means we don't need you to do this, Jerome, or the Federal Reserve to do this. But the first part is, okay, that's as a commodity reserve, but the Federal Reserve buys lots of shit that it doesn't say they can buy, and they do it through loopholes, like they buy companies' debt, they buy stock to put it aside as part of quantitative easing. So if they wanted to, they could buy ETFs holding Bitcoin in the current system, which would functionally operate the same as a reserve. Now, it's not what I think they should do. I don't even think they need to be involved. I'm just pointing out that he's not even being genuine in his answer, which seems genuine. The other side of that, though, is if the United States were to hold a Bitcoin reserve, there's absolutely no need or reason for the Federal Reserve to hold it. The Federal Reserve is a private group of banks chartered to do a thing by the federal government. They are not the federal government. They are a private organization. And the United States government has very little say in what the Fed does. The president appoints the chairman, but the chairman can be overridden by the board that you never even hear the names of the people that are on it. Okay, the chairman just is he's a mouthpiece. He's not really the decider. Remember George Bush? I'm the decider. He's not. Powell's not the decider. He's the explainer. Okay? Plain and simple. Okay, if the United States was to put up a Bitcoin reserve, the way to do it would be for the Treasury to fucking hold the fucking reserve. Okay, Jerome? Nobody's asking you to. So that's just an extra you got out of me today. And that could be done, and it probably will be done, and that can be done through executive fiat. All right. Not all fiats are fiat currencies. That just means that by stating it, it becomes, right? Okay, so now let's talk about the yellow journalism around what's going on in El Salvador. It's all over, guys. Bukele caved. He made a deal with the IMF. They're going to give him $1.5 billion loan, not even $1.5 billion grant or something like that, to do economic development in his country. And in return, he's turned his back on Bitcoin. Oh, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut the fuck up. So, when El Salvador made this move several years ago, and everybody said that the country would go broke from it, and they've been nothing but enriched by it, what a lot of Bitcoiners even said is, I'm not all in on all this, because there were certain things. One was, Bitcoin will be legal tender and treated as money in El Salvador, meaning if you buy Bitcoin today and spend it next week, and it went up, and it doubles, you don't pay any tax on the gain. It's just money. Okay, that stays the same. He's not changing that at all. That's the most important part. That's the most important part. The other, another thing that they did is they introduced a wallet provided by the El Salvadoran government so that merchants were not burdened by the requirement to accept Bitcoin. We'll get to that in a second. It's called a Chiva wallet or something like that, and they're going to unwind it, whatever that means. In other words, it will eventually go away. Knowing Bukele, he's smart. He'll probably make it open source, and somebody else can just pick it up and keep it running if they want to. The Salvadoran government won't handle it anymore, which is fine. I don't want the government handling anything that they don't need to be handling. Anyway, there's lots of choices for wallets, and I don't think anybody's going to be looking for a wallet not being able to find one in El Salvador, especially since all of the Lightning wallets will work in El Salvador because they don't have any prohibition against like KYC or something like that, because to them, it's just money. So that's not really giving anything up. The big change is that they will no longer require vendors to accept Bitcoin. It will be treated as legal tender, but you will have the option to say we don't take Bitcoin or we only take Bitcoin. We only take dollars or we don't take dollars. It's up to you, which is the way it should be anyway. Nobody should be telling somebody what they have to accept in return for the service or good that they reply. I don't think we should even have legal tender laws as they're understood, whereby this must be accepted as settlement of debt. Okay? And we don't to a degree because it doesn't even work that way. Right now in the United States, you can walk into a restaurant and they can say, we don't accept cash. The note says this is legal tender for all debts private. They can still say they don't take it. They can say we don't take any bills over 20s. They can say we only take credit cards. We don't take credit cards. Legal tender is really more about the settlement of debt if it has to be settled through state intervention. In other words, if I say that you harmed me by knocking my Apple card over and it cost me $500 worth of apples, I can't demand in court, if I prove that you did the damage to me, that you restore my apples. The court will say that you must pay me the denomination in dollars as legal tender. So it's all bullshit. None of it really matters, and this is the other thing. It was never really enforced anyway. What Bukele did was make sure that it got a fair shake, that people knew that they could do it. that knew people that could push for it. And at this point, with this many years behind it, saying, hey, look, I gave it to you, now use it if you want to, it's not really giving anything up. And I don't think that the state-provided wallet is being used hardly by anyone in El Salvador anyway. And so it was probably like, here's your concessions, suck it, because Bukele's like, yeah, we're still stacking one Bitcoin a day in El Salvador every single day, which is significant. I know that wouldn't seem like much if the United States was stacking one Bitcoin a day, but El Salvador is a country of about 6 million people. It's having an economic boom. Its tourism is through the roof. People are moving there. People are investing there. It's becoming a little economic powerhouse, and it's becoming one of the most low-crime nations in the world because Bukele was actually willing to do the hard work while everybody else screamed, you can't do it. Oh, and they found $3 trillion worth of gold that they can extract using this money. So I think El Salvador is going to be just fine and on a Bitcoin standard for a long fucking time. In fact, there's nothing in the agreement that would prevent Bukele from saying, thank you for your $1.5 billion. We're now going to invest $500 million in Bitcoin and $1 billion in the country. Thank you. Bye-bye. I am now Sailor Jr., right? That could happen too. Or we're going to use this money for this so we can use these other monies for that. You see what I'm saying? All right, now let's talk about the Russian cancer vaccine. You know, and there's an account that is a perfect example of why I'm doing this segment today. It's called Died Suddenly. And Died Suddenly, when the vax first started being mandated and pushed, did some really great work. They pointed out all of these athletes dying or having myocarditis, collapsing on the field and saying, hey, maybe we should look at this. Well, here's what's happened since then. I said this when the vax started going out. No, not everybody's going to get cancer. Not everybody's going to die. Not everybody's going to get sick. Some people are going to get it, and maybe it won't work, but it won't do anything to them at all. And some people will get it and have really strong reactions. Well, just like the flu or the virus itself, right, or the COVID virus or anything, the thing that's going to harm people in virgin territory happens the most in the beginning because the people most susceptible to it either die or it really hits them, and then they either develop, in the case of a virus, immunity by having been exposed to it, so they're no longer the most vulnerable of the population. Or, in the case of a vaccine, I had that, it really sucked, I'm not doing that again. So the vaccination rates on COVID are through the floor, so the side effects of the vaccine and the results of the vaccine are much lower than they were in the beginning because less people are doing it, and the people that had problems are either dead or won't do it again. Simple to understand. So what happens to an account like Died Suddenly, which is a huge account on X, is they run out of things to talk about. So then they start looking, because now I don't have anybody paying attention to me anymore. Okay, why don't you do some other good work? No. We'll just grab anything that looks like it might fit us. And so today they put out about Russia's cancer vaccine and said, first you invent the thing that causes the cancer, then you invent the vaccine for it. And I called them headline scraper readers only, is kind of how I responded to them. And this is why. Because if you actually knew what Russia was doing, there's no way you would make that claim. There's no way you would make that claim whatsoever. So Russia is actually using mRNA technology for this cancer vaccine the way that mRNA technology was originally intended to be used by the people that developed it, and in fact by Moderna itself all the way back when it was filing for its SEC approval to become a public corporation. See, it was never designed to be used in mass, meaning that we take the mRNA tech, we make one vaccine, and we give it to everybody. The people that helped develop it said, this is not what it's for. It doesn't work that way. It can't work that way. It's a poor use of the technology with large medical risk. However, what was it meant to do? It was meant to make individualized vaccines that were actually treatments. So instead of preventing an illness, it treated a condition you already had. And the most promising outlook for it was where, dun-dun-dun, for the treatment of cancers. Now, I told you this in probably March or April of 2020, which now is about 4 years ago. Son of a bitch if Russia is not actually using the technology the way it was designed. So how is Russia using this technology? How was it designed to be used? I'm sure this is the same answer. And what does that do, and why would it be effective? It works like this. Bill, unfortunately, has cancer. Let's say he has a certain type of, let's say he has prostate cancer. And the first thing a doctor wants to do to be thorough is just pop his freaking prostate out so he never really functions properly as a male again. Well, instead, what could actually be done is some of the cancer cells would be removed from Bill's prostate. And then his specific exact type of cancer, the exact cancer he's dealing with, would be then used to formulate a vaccine which is injected back in Bill. So it's primarily made from his own cells in his own body. And this would key up Bill's immune system, and that makes Bill's immune system attack the cancer instead of trying to poison the cancer with chemotherapy and radiation at a level that's sufficiently lethal to the cancer but doesn't completely kill Bill. Got it? See why I chose Bill for a name there? I know Bill and Steve and Tom are names I use all the time among men, very common names, but I chose Bill for a reason there, so it doesn't kill Bill, right? Okay. And so that's what this is. And what Russia's saying is, if you have cancer and you want this treatment, then in 2025 we're rolling this out, and if you're a Russian citizen that lives in Russia and you want this as a treatment, it's free. That's a terrible thing for... Wait a minute, that actually sounds like a pretty good idea. There's something else here. And you have to pay attention beyond the surface. Do you know who's been talking about a cure for cancer? A lot. Just you haven't heard it, except when it's been criticized in individual private conversations. That would be the Orange Man. This is coming to America, too. And it's important to know what it is. And I'm not going to tell you it's a wonderful thing that works, because I'm not a dumb fuck, and I don't know that yet. I know it's what was designed to do. I know that it might be very effective. I know that it might be a game changer. I also know this. It is likely the case that there will be this group of cancers, maybe highly treatable already, prostate, breast, testicular, etc. These cancers are somewhat easily treated compared to, you know, small cell, you know, carcinoma or something like that, or, you know, lymphoma or something like that. And then maybe there'll be some cancers, maybe even lymphoma, I don't know, that it's pretty good at. And then there'll be some that it really doesn't do shit for. And it'll probably also have a lot to do with what stage did you catch it in, etc. Like, you know, if it can actually change the course of what's expected for people with seriously lethal cancers that are almost always lethal within a year or two or less, like liver and pancreatic, then it's the ultimate game changer. I don't know that it will be. We'll have to wait and see. We'll have to see what comes out. But I will tell you this. It is not the same as making a vaccine for a cold or a flu or a virus or a bacteria and vaccinating 300 million people in mass. It is not the same. It should not be treated the same. And anybody who treats it the same needs to be fucking ignored. The only way to cure Gelman amnesia is when somebody is defiantly giving you false information and they refuse to correct themselves, they become an unreliable source. And we have to do that with mainstream media. We have to do that with alternative media. And we also have to do that with just it's almost like a new form of media that we have now, a new form of the news. The collective mind of the hive, the collective mind of the people, will be right more than it is wrong, but it will also be spectacularly wrong from time to time. As we've seen, if you had taken a vote, should we have lockdowns and mandatory vaccines as soon as the vaccine becomes available about June of 2020, it would have had way more than a majority of people would have said yes. And those of us who were saying this is insanity, this is stupid, we're hiding from the cold, we're told that we were grandma killers and we were anti-science, and we've been proven right over and over and over again, and that number would swing now. But you can't always trust the mind of the hive. You really can't. But again, look at you Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Probably 75% of the time when they use the lifeline of Ask the audience is right. And that means that we can gain a lot from it, but we have to treat the hive mind, alternative media, and mainstream media the same. You can never look at the surface. You have to look at the undertone, and you have to... Did I say not to listen to that subtly? I said not to trust them as a source anymore. They can't be trusted. There's still a window to look out of the room. Look out as many windows as possible before you draw a conclusion, But the first conclusion to draw is, do I even give a shit? Because if you don't care, spend your time doing something else. With that, I want to wrap things up. I want to thank you for tuning in today. I want to remind you about some of our items of the day this week that you can check out. The Vavor air compressor, the emergency air compressor tire inflator, that thing's awesome. It really would make a great gift. There's still time probably to order things and get them by Christmas from Vavor. The Olietta stainless steel olive oil bottle, that thing's great. The Conical Burr coffee grinder from Vavor, that thing's great. The Hamilton Beach egg cooker has become my number one selling item of 2024 in 3 weeks versus a whole year for some other products. I've sold hundreds of them. But I have had no negative feedback whatsoever on that little $20 product. So all of those are worth checking out. If you're going to buy anything last minute Christmas, going into next year, whatever, remember always, you find all my reviews. And you help us out by starting your shopping at tspaz.com. On your Vavor buys, you can save an additional 5% off everything you buy. On Amazon, it doesn't save you any more money, but it doesn't cost you any more. And you help out the show that you listen to that gives you all this great information. With that, I will catch you guys on Monday with one more new show before we shut down for the holiday. We'll have rewinds and holiday shows after that. The survivalist view of Christmas and stuff like that will be coming. And then we'll come back and we'll do it all again. The first show back again will be the 2nd of January, I think. And it will be a Thursday, so it will be an expert counsel Q&A show. Take care, guys. Happy holidays. Merry Christmas. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.